I'm Chris Bowlby, and this programme is called Palace of Shame. It's about how one dramatic event in Beijing in the middle of the 19th century still hangs over relations between today's China and the West. In a park near the centre of Beijing, amid ruins of an ornate fountain, hundreds of Chinese tourists are visiting what they regard as a crime scene. And the destruction of the old summer palace in 1860 prompts not only regret about the past, but defiance about the future.
I'm very angry at these invaders because they've already looted this garden and robbed whatever they can, stole whatever they can. Why can't you just keep this beautiful garden as it was? Why don't you just ruin everything here? It just reminds us our memory when we learned, you know, this about this history back in middle school, elementary school, in our textbook. So I think the lesson we should learn is if you are falling behind, you will be attacked. So when we go back home, we will teach our children, don't forget the humiliation we've been through.
This place has been described as China's ground zero. What happened here, the looting of thousands of works of art from a complex of imperial palaces and gardens by invading French and British forces, and then the decision by the British commander, Lord Elgin, to burn it all to the ground, is a story every Chinese child learns about. But it's little known in the West. French historian Bernard Brizet.
I would like that all the citizens of the world, and especially British citizens, to know what happened in Beijing in October 1860. This palace was a marvel, a wonder, une, in French, merveille du monde. As a French citizen, I would say it is as if the Prussians, during our 1870 war, had been destroying the palace of Versailles to the ground, looting the Louvre Museum and burning the French National Library.
Or imagine, as one Chinese historian put it to me, an army coming from China to London, removing the contents of the British Museum and burning down Buckingham Palace. Everyone in Britain has heard of the Elgin marbles taken by the 7th Earl of Elgin from Greece. What happened in the expedition led in China by his son, the 8th Earl, is barely remembered, though it ended in looting and architectural destruction on a far larger scale. And this matters now. Learning the history of the old summer palace will also reveal how communist-ruled China exploits its history and how today's new opening to China, in culture as well as politics and economics, has reignited debate about this extraordinary place. So what was the Summer Palace and why its hold on Chinese imagination? At a corner of the site of the old Summer Palace grounds, I met Professor Guo Daihong, an architectural specialist from Tsinghua University.
I came to old Summer Palace the first time when I came to university. And it's about 50 or even 60 years ago. And at that time, the whole Old Summer Palace was very deserted, abandoned. But once I started my research on Old Summer Palace, I came visited Old Summer Palace so many times, keep coming back with my students. The more we studied on it, the more obsessed we become with it.
它就是被世界誉为万园之园的圆明园。 That obsession has now produced a digital reconstruction by an international team of what the site, known in Chinese as Yuanmingyuan, or Garden of Perfect Brightness, was like. Over its 35 hectares, successive Manchu emperors from the Qing dynasty laid out an intricate landscape with buildings for politics, religion and culture, and accumulated stunning works of art and precious books and manuscripts.
My name is Alexandra Hara. I am from Austria. I studied in the United States and now I'm in China. I am assistant professor at Tsinghua University at the School of Architecture and I'm involved in the virtual reconstruction project by CID, that's the Tsinghua Heritage Institute for Digitization. And our aim is to revive the old summer palace, the lost architecture of the old summer palace by using virtual technology.
...将这东方幻想艺术的结晶
It started out as a very small princely garden, and it was enlarged over a period of, let's say, at the beginning of 100 or 50 years even, and it became one of the major political centers of the whole Chinese Empire. You know, the architecture here, it has a lot of different buildings. It has monasteries, and there were also some his personal retreat areas where he just, for example, there were some theaters. And a certain part of the garden, it's a little bit like a countryside. You can find fields, and they were growing crops and everything, because the emperor wanted to know about the life outside of his small complex. And so what he was building here was a microcosmos of his whole empire.
But this was not only a spectacular celebration of Chinese culture. Influenced by Jesuits, Christian missionaries from Europe who joined the imperial household, parts of the complex were built in European styles, such as Rococo. Its ruins now symbolize conflict, but its buildings once showed a remarkable fusion of Eastern and Western culture.
The Western buildings are a natural choice because the emperor thought that his power is so huge that why should he not have something from the West here? It seemed logical to him that this is also part of his world. And I think if you look at contemporary European emperors, they had the same idea. They loved everything from like this foreign country that was called Katai or China. I mean, in their own way of thinking, this was also part of their culture because they were so powerful that this didn't seem to be any conflict.
But conflict was precisely what was looming for the Chinese emperors in the mid-19th century as war intruded into those palace gardens and lakes celebrating tranquility and heavenly peace. The Opium Wars exposed China's weakness faced by the military and economic power of Britain and the West. And in 1860, an Anglo-French force led by the 8th Lord Elgin approached Beijing.
There were many, many unresolved tensions between the Qing and the foreign powers.
Professor Robert Bickers, author of The Scramble for China, Foreign Devils and the Qing Empire.
After 3 years of campaigning, and in 1859, an Anglo-French expedition to North China, which had been very effectively rebuffed with great loss of life to the British and French. So in 1860, the British and French, under the combined command of Lord Elgin, heading north to once and for all put an end to the war, as they see it, and to secure the agreement of the Qing to a whole raft of new concessions.
The potential for mutual misunderstanding and delusion was huge. I was told of one Chinese emperor who asked his advisers to point out Britain on a world map, looked at how small it was and said, well, nothing to worry about then. And on the British side, gung-ho imperialism on the one hand, but fascination with Chinese culture on the other. And here's where my personal link with this story comes in, because my ancestor, Thomas Bowlby, was in 1860 a pioneering foreign correspondent, travelling with Lord Elgin and the British force.
These are men who were men of their times, but they had also travelled widely, thought widely. And when Bowlby writes from China, it's a very, very complicated and complex account.
Professor Vera Schwartz of Wesleyan University has studied the relationship between Bowlby the journalist and Lord Elgin the commander, begun as they travelled from Britain towards China in 1860.
I was struck by the relationship between two men in Egypt. They travelled, you know, by boat, of course, and they'd stopped in Egypt, and they went out to see the pyramids, and they woke up at dawn and climbed up to gaze at the Sphinx in the very first rays of the sun. And again, there's a marvelous entry in Elgin's journal when he talks about Mr. Bowlby being very sympathique and their shared reflections on the meaning of history, the future of humankind. These are men that thought broadly, felt deeply, and they had not come to China to destroy a civilization. I don't think there was any intention at the beginning of 1860 to destroy the Summer Palace.
You can sense in Thomas Bowlby's diaries and reports some of the contradictions and misunderstandings in the British mind. At times, he's full of curiosity and admiration for Chinese society and landscape. Here's a piece where he's praising buildings with fine timber. A bit hard to imagine in today's Beijing suburbs around me, full of traffic and skyscrapers. Here's a piece where he writes of admirably cultivated gardens with excellent French beans and magnificent fruit. At other times, he's the sober war correspondent telling his readers that the British Army's new Armstrong gun inflicts perfectly awful wounds on the Chinese. It smashes whatever it comes in contact with. And then he's the imperially confident observer of what he expects will be an easy victory over the effete and faithless mandarins who rule Imperial China. In one of his last reports, published in the Times newspaper, dated September the 11th, 1860, he says two mandarins have brought in a flag of truce. The Chinese, he adds, will soon be suing for mercy. It was, for him and others around him, a fatal miscalculation. Yet at first, all seemed to be proceeding well for the Anglo-French expedition, reinforced by Indian army troops. In a campaign lasting a few months, their superior weapons and organisation triumphed, and they approached Beijing relentlessly. While Bowlby the journalist headed off with negotiators to witness, they assumed, Chinese capitulation, French troops reached the outskirts of Beijing. They found the Summer Palace abandoned by the emperor. Lord Elgin, as he recorded in his journal, arrived a few days later.
Sunday, October the 7th, 1860. I have just returned from the Summer Palace. It is really a fine thing, like an English park. Numberless rooms filled with Chinese curios and handsome clocks, bronzes, etc. But what a scene of desolation.
Causing this desolation was an orgy of looting, still the subject of bitter controversy today. Soldiers rushing around, grabbing everything from vases to silks to precious books, and smashing what they couldn't carry. Looting was seen in those days as part of the business of war, a way of offering additional rewards to poorly paid troops. Yet Elgin, no stranger to such practices, claimed to be shocked by the scale of what was going on.
I tried to get a regiment of ours sent to guard the place, and then sell the things by auction. But it is difficult to get things done by system in such a case. Plundering and devastating a place like this is bad enough, but what is much worse is the waste and breakage. French soldiers were destroying in every way the most beautiful silks, breaking the jade ornaments and porcelain, etc. War is a hateful business. The more one sees of it, the more one detests it.
But before long, British forces joined in. Officers and men seemed to have been seized with temporary insanity, said one witness. In body and soul, they were absorbed in one pursuit, which was plunder, plunder. Guilty consciences were apparent, and still are today, as historical war is waged over who was most to blame. Here's French historian Bernard Briset, author of The Sacking of the Summer Palace, recently translated into Chinese.
The French troops began the looting of the Summer Palace first, because the English had lost their way. The British were furious, not because the French had begun to loot, but because they did it without them. Both were looting together a bit later. But the British, I could say, were professionals, and the French, amateurs.
What's not in doubt is that many thousands of items were taken or auctioned and brought to Britain and France, filling royal and private collections and museums. And, as we'll hear, they're still resurfacing controversially in art markets today.
At that moment, all constraints and rules were broken. An army that had observed the strictest possible discipline and action, suddenly bereft of all morals.
Chinese documentaries on these events, made for an international audience by state TV, don't mince their words.
They took anything they could. And if they couldn't take them, they destroyed them without mercy.
It remains an appalling vision of greed and vandalism, though Vera Schwartz suggests we might want to bear in mind how soldiers and political powers on all sides used to behave when it came to cultural property.
They were grabbing at material remains, which I think are what we call the spoils of war. Did they understand that these were treasures of many, many centuries of Chinese art, that the Manchu emperors had looted themselves from Chinese artists and collectors and literatis from the previous dynasties, because that's what Qianlong did. I mean, that collection, much of what he amassed, was not something that he bought or ordered, or, you know, he owned it because he requisitioned it because Chinese culture does have a distinctive aesthetic and it's so different from what was the Western one, it moves us retrospectively. They're very beautiful things that were abused and torn apart and shattered.
But the looting was far from the end of the story. There was to be a final act in the assertion of Western power over the bewildered and impotent Chinese imperial state, an act that still hangs like a pall over relations between China and Britain. The decision taken by Lord Elgin to burn all the Summer Palace's buildings, its residences and temples, theatres and libraries, to the ground.
The Earl believed that we had to deal a blow to the Qing government, and the Emperor was to be the direct target of our attack. As Yuan Mingyuan was the Emperor's favourite place, destroying it was the best possible decision.
The Chinese version of events has Elgin wielding his power in the crudest way possible. But there is another side to this story, barely featuring in Chinese accounts, but which makes Elgin's decision more personal, if no less catastrophic in its cultural consequences. And it's an uncomfortable story for me to uncover, as the murder of my ancestor, the journalist Thomas Bowlby, is at its centre. He'd gone earlier with British and French negotiators and soldiers to accept they assumed Chinese surrender, but they'd been taken prisoner and held for a while in the Summer Palace. Some were released, but Bowlby and several others were tortured and died of their wounds. Their mangled bodies returned later to Lord Elgin's headquarters. Vera Schwartz.
When the bodies begin to come back and accounts, those men that were freed, talk about the torture, that for 3 days these men were tied up and their bandages, you know, soaked with water, so they'd become tighter and tighter. And every time they begged for water, their mouths would be filled with dirt. These were horrific stories. And so when Elgin tried to understand, or really not understand, how could this civilization, so-called civilization, take men in these pleasure palaces and subject them to such abuse, I think that was the final straw.
These other images from China at that time.
Yes, this is the body he discovered.
So here we have a picture. It's a coffin with a torch above it, shedding light. Whose body is this?
Well, I think this is Bowlby.
To try and understand what was going through Elgin's mind as he took this fateful decision, I visited the current Lord Elgin, the 11th Earl, in the old ancestral home near Edinburgh. His family's used to being in the firing line over matters imperial, especially the Elgin marbles, but he's rarely spoken in public. A keen student of events in 1860, he showed me drawings from the family archives recording the moment Bowlby's tortured body was returned.
Yes, the return of the prisoners, identification of the bodies by moonlight.
And it was then that Lord Elgin began to decide what he was going to do in response.
Yes.
Which in the end led to the burning of the Summer Palace.
Yes.
Do you feel that the need to defend his reputation, the reputation of his father, they're very caught up in historical debate about the empire, aren't they?
It's almost inevitable that you're always defending your predecessors. So somebody will find some miserable thing that they think you were up to. So you have to be fairly rock-like in your defence. By and large, there are things that perhaps you might have done differently, but at the same time, you've got to judge what was the feeling, intense feeling, at that particular moment when it all happened.
October the 14th, 1860. We have dreadful news respecting the fate of some of our captured friends. It is an atrocious crime, and not for vengeance but for future security, ought to be severely dealt with.
Elgin's own words in his diary at the time record his response to the hostage's death. You sense the loss of face, his attempt to impose British authority and rules in China rejected in the most brutally defiant way. And was he fearful, too, of how this would be seen back in London? He'd relied on Thomas Bowlby to send back glowing accounts of his China campaign. What would the Times say of me, he reportedly said to a French officer, if I did not avenge its correspondent?
Having, to the best of my judgment, examined the question in all its bearings, I came to the conclusion that the destruction of Yuan Mingyuan was the least objectionable of several courses open to me. It was the Emperor's favourite residence, and its destruction could not fail to be a blow to his pride as well as to his feelings. As almost all the valuables had already been taken from the palace, the army would go there not to pillage, but to mark by a solemn act of retribution the horror and indignation with which we were inspired by the perpetration of a great crime.
It was a punishment, Elgin claimed, aimed at the emperor, not the Chinese people. The French disagreed with his decision, though some say they wanted to destroy the Forbidden City instead. Whatever the arguments, the end result was that on October the 18th, 1860, the day after Thomas Bowlby and his fellow victims were buried, teams of British troops arrived at the fabulous grounds and buildings that comprised the Summer Palace and began to burn them. Their commander was General Sir Hope Grant, noted chess player, cellist and diarist.
It was a magnificent sight. I could not but grieve at the destruction of so much ancient grandeur, and felt that it was an uncivilized proceeding. But I believed it to be necessary, as a future warning to the Chinese against the murder of European envoys and the violation of the law of nations.
On the morning of October the 18th, 1860, 3,500 British infantrymen and cavalrymen, following the orders of Elgin and Grant, began to systematically burn Yuan Mingyuan to the ground.
I've come to a part of the Summer Palace grounds now, well away from the crowds. It was once a beautiful landscaped area of lakes and villages and many buildings, and now there are just a few desolate piles of stones, very hard to imagine what was there. And I can't help thinking of what went through the minds of the British forces as they passed through and burnt all these buildings to the ground in 1860. I remember reading some reminiscences from Robert McGee, who was chaplain to the British forces, and he wrote, "Stern and dire was the need that a blow should be struck, which should be felt at the very heart's core of the government of China, and it was done." But he went on to write about really how he regretted what had happened. "It was a sacrifice of all that was most ancient and most beautiful. It's gone," he writes, "but I don't know how to tear myself from it. I love to linger over the recollection and to picture it to myself, but I cannot make you see it.
A man must be a poet, a painter, an historian, a virtuoso, a Chinese scholar, and I don't know how many other things besides, to give you even an idea of it. But whenever I think of beauty and taste, of skill and antiquity while I live, I shall see before my mind's eye some scene from those grounds, those palaces, and ever regret the stern but just necessity which laid them in ashes."
A Richer World from the BBC World Service. They're young.
The new Africa is made up of people like me. Young businessmen that have started businesses from nothing.
Ambitious.
Most people say that the sky is the limit. For me, it's not the limit. It's like the lower limit.
And proud to be African.
Me, myself, I feel like I'm very much part of the new Africa.
So what are their hopes for the future? The BBC's Alan Kasuja travels to three countries in East Africa to find out.
As part of our Richer World season, I'm bringing you My Africa, the series where I meet young people ringing the changes across my own native East Africa.
In the first program, he hears from young entrepreneurs in Uganda.
My vision for Africa is one where business leads the way and actually makes the difference in the day-to-day lives of everyday Africans.
My Africa on the BBC World Service. Online at bbcworldservice.com.
In the second half of this programme, I'll discover why today's Chinese Communist Party is so interested in what happened to the Summer Palace in 1860. And what about all that looted art brought back to Europe by British and French soldiers? I'll be tracking it down in British museums and auction houses, where it's still making headlines today. Join me, Chris Bowlby, for more revelations about the Palace of Shame, coming up after the news.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. Libyan jihadists, who say they're allied with Islamic State militants, have posted online a video purporting to show the killing of at least 10 Egyptian Coptic Christians. It appears they were killed only because of their religion. 21 Copts are known to be missing in Libya, and last week the jihadists posted a video of them. The leaders of France and Germany have said they're satisfied the ceasefire in eastern Ukraine is being broadly observed. Witnesses say in most areas there's an uneasy calm, the one exception being around the town of Debaltseve, where pro-Russian rebels have continued to attack the government forces they've surrounded in the strategic transport hub. A rescue operation is underway in the Mediterranean, where the Italian Coast Guard tries to save more than 1,000 migrants stranded on boats south of the island of Lampedusa. A spokesman said so far more than 130 people have been rescued. It's thought better weather over the past few days has encouraged more crossings. The man suspected of killing two people in a shooting spree in Denmark has been named as Omar El Hussein. Police say he was 22 years old and had a history of gang-related violence. Local media are reporting that he'd been released from prison 2 weeks ago, having served a sentence for assault. He was shot by police on Sunday. A Jewish cemetery in eastern France has been the target of what the authorities say is an anti-Semitic attack. Hundreds of tombstones were knocked down and desecrated at the graveyard in Saint-Union. The government said the country would not tolerate such an infringement of the values all French people share. A Palestinian rap group has threatened legal action after the right-wing Likud party of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu used its music in an election campaign advertisement. The group said Likud was also endangering their lives. BBC News.
I'm Chris Bowlby, and I'm telling the story of the looting and destruction of the Imperial Summer Palace in Beijing in 1860 by invading British and French forces. The palace complex contained spectacular buildings and many valuable and precious works of art. I want to find out why China still feels so strongly about this today, and how all the looted art taken still affects the international art market. In the first part of the programme, we heard how the commander of the British forces, Lord Elgin, said he burnt the palace down as a punishment after hostages sent to negotiate a truce with the Chinese emperor were tortured and murdered. What, I wondered, do Chinese scholars think of this explanation? Chinese scholars are impatient with the idea of British regret about what was done in 1860. I went to see Professor Wang Daochang, an engaging, energetic man, his flat in an old part of Beijing full of piles of yellowing research papers and documents, a small statue of Chairman Mao peeping out of one cupboard. He sees talk of Lord Elgin reacting angrily to the hostages' treatment as an attempt to excuse Britain's aggressive behaviour.
Yes. What they say is 37 French and English prisoners of war were tortured inside Yuan Mingyuan. Some of them died. But not all of them died inside the Yuan Mingyuan. This is what they say to justify their actions. That's the way they try to maintain the so-called moral high ground. From what we see today in the world, too, if you want to find a reason to do something, then you get your justification.
Professor Daochang's been researching the old summer palace for decades. But when he and colleagues first began, it was nothing like the site of national commemoration it's become today.
When we got to the outskirts of Yuan Mingyuan, we couldn't drive anymore. There was no gate, no walls. We just walked in, and what we saw was a wasteland, just like a normal countryside. There were some lowly peasant huts, dogs barking, chickens clucking, crops growing.
What this indicates is that for a long time after its destruction, the site of the old summer palace barely registered in Chinese memory. Locals exploited its remains for building materials. And after the communists came to power in 1949, the site was initially used for collective agriculture. Indeed, its imperial past as a creation of the Qing dynasty, argues Vera Schwartz, made it a target for renewed attack by Red Guards during the 1960s Cultural Revolution, a period of violent communist radicalism unleashed by Chairman Mao.
Some pieces of that remnants from the Summer Palace that were then literally slashed with knives by the Red Guards. You know, in the corners of Peking University, there are these remnants that did survive the burning. And then the Red Guards, in addition to torturing intellectuals to death, had to pick up their knives and their chisels and gash whatever was left from the Qing.
But in more recent decades, the fate of the Yuanmingyuan has rapidly become the centrepiece of a new communist-backed history designed to make the Chinese think differently about the past and the present. Professor Robert Bickers.
The big change does come really with the 1989 democracy movement, the Tiananmen movement. In the aftermath of that, the Chinese Communist Party decided that key problems involved the fact that young Chinese people did not appreciate what the Communist Party had done for China in terms of rebuilding its prestige internationally, rolling back and contesting foreign imperialism. So they embarked on what was called the Patriotic Education Movement, and a tremendous amount of funding has been put into this, into building new history museums, places which are related to the century of China's national humiliation, as it is described.
And the site of the Summer Palace, the drama of its story of foreign imperial invasion, looting and destruction, is a place ideally suited to this patriotic education push. There's a brisk trade in educational souvenirs, though I couldn't find one I'd heard about, a national humiliation cigarette lighter commemorating the 1860 burning. Culture ministry guides armed with megaphones tell visitors among the ruins that today's China must be strong to prevent all this happening again. And one striking question thrown at me by a war veteran proudly wearing his medals was this: why doesn't the West give back all the art that was looted in 1860? It's a question that's been used to embarrass visiting politicians too, raised widely on Chinese social media, for example, when British Prime Minister David Cameron visited China in 2013. So, what did happen to all that loot, and who's on its trail today? One of the organisations most involved in trying to recover cultural treasures that have been lost from China is the National Treasure Fund. And its Director General, Niu Xianfeng, has come to meet me in a nice historic location, one of the parks in Beijing that dates back to the Ming Dynasty. Tell me, how does your fund go about trying to find works of art that were taken in 1860?
Our main work is to track down the original position of this immovable antique. And then we will do lots of research on its current owner and where it is owned right now. What's the story after it was taken to the foreign countries? We made a plan to start a series of actions to recover these antiques and get them back to China.
Do you have the support of the Chinese government in this project?
Chinese government has made very clear message when signing the international agreement with other countries that China will never give up the right to bring all these looted or stolen treasures back.
The government in Beijing may be wary of pressing its demands too far. It knows that legally the restitution of works of art taken so long ago is unlikely. Nor would it want to jeopardise the chances of selling, say, high-speed trains or nuclear power stations to Britain in the name of avenging the Summer Palace's destruction. But below the level of government and its agencies, there is a younger generation of Chinese researchers and campaigners who want, at the very least, the West to acknowledge more openly what it did and where so much of its Chinese art has come from. Liu Yang is now going through his iPad. He's got hundreds of images of items that he's tracked down that came from the Summer Palace. He's been looking through auction catalogues and other sources to try and work out exactly where all these items have come to, and there just are hundreds. Liu Yang is the author of a book published in China called Who's Collecting Yuanmingyuan, i.e. the former contents of the old Summer Palace. As we sat on the steps of the Beijing National Library, he used his computer to show me how he spent years tracking down how loot from the Summer Palace passed through great homes and auction houses in France and Britain, and where it's ended up now. One place is the great museum collections, though he's had little success finding out directly from them.
I've been studying this for more than 15 years. I got help from the American Museum, Japanese Museum, but never from French and British museums. A French museum, they give you a reply by saying, no, we don't know it, or you should contact someone else. British museums never reply.
So what could I find back in Britain? I checked with some collections. The Wallace Collection in London, for example, confirmed it had a beautiful imperial wine cup made with gold, pearls and precious stones, originally from the Summer Palace. The Royal Family's Art Collection has a number of items which came from the palace, as well as a painting of a Pekingese dog brought back from China in 1861, presented to Queen Victoria, and somewhat insensitively nicknamed Looty. And then, further afield, there are the military museums across the country. Material taken from the Summer Palace in 1860 can still be found all over Britain. This is the Museum of the Royal Engineers, a famous military unit in Gillingham in Kent. Outside, what you would expect, specialist vehicles and guns. But inside is a surprising collection of Chinese art.
The name's James Scott, and I'm Deputy Curator of Exhibitions and Galleries at the Royal Engineers Museum. What I have is a jade ornament fashioned in the shape of a lotus flower, and it actually functions as a kind of bowl. This is sort of typical of the things that would have been taken by the soldiers at the sacking of the Summer Palace.
It's all mounted on parts of what looks like a really ornate carved throne. How does that come to be there?
The throne was actually brought back in various pieces by a royal engineer called Charles Gordon, made famous by his death in Khartoum later on. He brought it back in several pieces and donated it to the Royal Engineers Mess.
So it just sat there while they were having their dinners and so on for how long?
It sat for about 120 years, I think, and it was just underneath a picture of the king.
How have the objects been displayed? I mean, they are essentially loot.
We do have to be sensitive. They were essentially looted, but we don't actually mention the word loot at all. We try to keep the interpretation as neutral as possible, if you will.
Why is that?
For one thing, some of these things aren't necessarily owned by us, the museum. For example, they're owned by the Mess. Every time something like this appears in the news, you do get a few phone calls saying, have you got any intention to give these things back? But we sort of take the lead of the National Museums, and the sort of precedent for it is to sort of hold fire, I guess, yeah.
What sometimes prompts those headlines is news of lucrative sales in today's booming Chinese art market of what was once Summer Palace loot. Ironically enough, being able to prove it was taken by British or French troops in 1860 can hugely increase its value today.
My name is Guy Swinge, and I'm one of the partners at Duke's Auctioneers in Dorchester, Dorset. We were called to a house in West Dorset to look at some Chinese artefacts. And when I arrived, the client told me that her ancestor had bought these items back. He was part of the troop involved in the Summer Palace episode. And I was obviously jolly excited because it would insinuate that there were going to be some imperial works of art, and slightly nervous because of the implications of where they'd come from.
And how could you be sure that they'd come from there?
Well, that was the interesting point. One of the artefacts was a stunning watch, a gold and enamel watch set with diamonds and pearls, which had been made in China for the Western taste. And inscribed on the back, it actually recorded it belonged to James Gunter and that he'd acquired it from the Summer Palace in 1860. So we had a firm point at which we could work. And the quality of the other items was such that they were of imperial quality, and therefore it was impossible really to doubt that they'd come from the Summer Palace as well.
And how well did they do in the market?
Phenomenally well. We had a tiny white jade cup and saucer, only about 3 inches tall, which sold for just over £500,000. And a very beautiful yellow jade ring, which we sold for nearly £600,000 from memory.
So there's a kind of irony here that if you can find something that's, say, inscribed, taken from the Summer Palace or looted, that's really good on the one hand because it proves where it came from. On the other hand, it does raise these sensitive issues as far as the Chinese are concerned.
Absolutely right, yeah. I think one has to be sensitive at all times. But the provenance is key.
There's potentially much more to emerge as hundreds of soldiers in 1860 helped themselves to thousands of works of art. Wealthy Chinese collectors may be very keen to acquire such beautiful and unique items, but the appearance of what was originally loot in today's auctions does not go down well in China itself. Historian Robert Bickers.
There have been several instances recently where significant objects which had been looted from the Summer Palace came onto the international auction market. And in a couple of instances, Chinese bidders bid for these and won and then refused to pay. And their argument being that these objects, which should never have been on auction, should have been returned to China. And in a couple of cases recently, some objects have actually been returned by a French owner to China. So there is much more Chinese public sensitivity about this than there ever used to be.
All those years ago, because of war, my ancestors brought back things that did not belong to them. And every time I look at that bronze, it shouldn't belong to one or two individuals.
And that sensitivity has been reinforced in millions of Chinese minds thanks to a recent film, Chinese Zodiac, by the martial arts star Jackie Chan. He's a vigorous campaigner on the old Summer Palace issue and plays here a daredevil hero attempting to recover from evil Western collectors and museums bronze-carved zodiac heads, among the most famous items looted in 1860. But Chinese sensitivity has made some Western owners and dealers more wary of dealing with items linked to the Summer Palace. John Axford from Woolley and Wallace Auctioneers in the west of England is an Asian art expert on BBC TV's Antiques Roadshow.
If you go back through auction catalogues of all of the major sale rooms and ours, you will find things catalogued and provenanced from the Yuan Ming Yuan, the old Summer Palace. Nowadays, auctioneers would be advised probably to be more reticent about that.
And why has that happened?
The Chinese are in a very different position now than they were. It's only recently China has become a very important world power, and the Chinese, much in the same way the Greeks, I suppose, demand the return of the Elgin marbles from the British Museum, they would like the contents of the Yuan Ming Yuan returned.
Ah, yes, the Elgin marbles. How curious it is that the cultural acquisitions from Greece of one Lord Elgin are still so much discussed in Britain, yet his son's role in 1860, when the old Summer Palace in Beijing was looted, is far less remembered.
So here we have a rather magnificent pair of stork bird sculptures in bronze.
Yes, they were found in the Summer Palaces and bought by Lord Elgin's staff. They are, in fact, presents from the Emperor of Japan. They are Japanese, although they were found in China.
So they'd been given by the Emperor of Japan to the Emperor in China
and
were in the Summer Palace.
On my visit to the Elgin ancestral home at Broomhall, I was shown by the current Lord Elgin some of the items from China that came into his family's possession. How, I wanted to know, did the 8th Lord Elgin view what he'd done in China once he returns to Britain?
Almost immediately after he'd returned, he was invited to the annual dinner of the National Gallery, and there he spoke very movingly, I think, about the reason why he'd made this decision, and of course the loss of so many beautiful things having been destroyed.
I am not so incorrigibly barbarous as to be incapable of feeling the humanizing influences which fall upon us from the noble works of art by which we are surrounded. And as I have ventured to approach so nearly to the margin of a burning question, I hope that I may be able to take one step more in the same direction, and to assure you that no one regretted more sincerely than I did the destruction of that collection of summer houses and kiosks, already and previously to any act of mine rifled of their contents, which was dignified by the title Summer Palace of the Chinese Emperor.
Do you think he had a guilty conscience?
And it was difficult for him, yes.
Did he regret the decision, do you think?
You know, he's very firm about, once he'd made his mind up, I don't think he ever did regret about anything. What I find so interesting about his character, that once he'd decided something, well, that was it. It was very difficult to move him.
I felt that the time had come when I must choose between the indulgence of a not unnatural sensibility and the performance of a painful duty.
How do you respond when the claim is made that things should be returned to where they were taken from? It comes up a lot in the case of your family, but the Chinese have been saying these objects should be returned to us.
Yes, but it's a very good arguing point. But you can never actually return the beauty of something. It's inherent in it wherever it happens to be. These things happen.
The government now in Britain is very keen for relations with the new China, lots of visits there and so on. Do you think pressure might come from the British side to do something about this?
Well, things do happen in history. But the great thing is that if they have an important, which I believe they do, which was to create a relationship of trust and understanding, that you go ahead rather than look back all the time.
And Lord Elgin has had his own taste of the future of British-Chinese relations in a very different era. Today's British Navy, successor to those gunboats used to force open China and its markets and transport invading armies in the 19th century, is now being built with Chinese help in Rosyth Dockyard, very near the Elgin ancestral home.
A crane built in Shanghai, together with the Chinese who built it, arrived at Rosyth Dockyard within sight of the house here in order to create the aircraft carrier which has just been launched. From the top of the crane, the Chinese workmen looked onto my fields and saw the blossoming of my rape crop. "Oh," they said, and scampered down and began slicing off the tops of my rape in order to brew it up as an aphrodisiac. And unfortunately, I don't speak Chinese, and they couldn't understand why I didn't want them to have this. But they did get a tit-for-tat in the end.
Probably not the kind of compensation most Chinese have in mind for what happened in 1860. But perhaps the opportunities of today's globalisation can help heal wounds or encourage everyone to forget the painful past. Incidentally, when I went to see what was the burial place of my ancestor Thomas Bowlby in Beijing, I found no trace of history, but simply a golf driving range. So will the megaphone message of patriotic education, that what happened at the Summer Palace was the height of national humiliation by the West, lose its impact as younger Chinese embrace a more international attitude? Or will they take on this history, but in a new way? Schools have always been an important place where the traditional patriotic story of what happened to the Summer Palace in 1860 has been passed on between the generations. But I've been told about one place that is trying to rethink how all this is taught. It's a middle school just near to the site of the Summer Palace in Beijing. And I've come to the school canteen to meet teachers and students who've been looking in new ways at this controversial history. One of the teachers, Han Xing, explained how they'd encouraged the children to use historical material to research the architecture and history of the old Summer Palace and think independently.
Yes, here we are. There's a guidebook written in English, a cover note, how the Qing dynasty built Yuanming Yuang, the out-of-the-world palace, let me tell you, in this guidebook.
They're hoping to change the curriculum, the way this is taught in Chinese schools. But how far, I wonder, did the Communist Party still guide treatment of this most sensitive historical topic?
You know, actually all these three stages of learning method, teaching method, was originally put up by party secretary of our school. So he opens all green light.
So the party's encouraging debate perhaps, but keeping an eye on what's happening. What about the pupils?
My Chinese name is Xue Wenhui.
And my name is Yin Xinru.
Before, our teacher just tell us what is right and what is wrong, and we know, okay. But this time, we know that everyone has mistakes.
Our research is about the relationship between the British and French in the burning up the old Summer Palace. And we read through thousands of documents by ourselves, and teachers taught us how to compile the facts and figures into one big form.
And you studied what was there before. What do you feel now about the fact that it was burnt in 1860?
Actually, the Old Summer Palace is a palace. It's the Garden of Gardens in China. It represents both Chinese and Western architectures. If it is remained till now, thousands of visitors will come here in China. But it is burnt. It is a regret to all of us. And we can all see the remains. When I visit there, I believe that China is still not too strong.
What do you feel about the Summer Palace now? You've studied what it looked like, and then a lot of it was destroyed in 1860. How do you feel about that?
We have to see this thing in different ways, because they have their own reason to burn it.
Do you think there are lessons for China today in what happened?
Yeah, I think it's a lesson that if we are not strong enough, we will be insulted by others.
You can't fail to be impressed by these multilingual schoolgirls happily discussing the complexities of what happened in 1860. But still there is a version of that old message, that feeling that this was a kind of huge insult to China that needs a strong response today.
Here you can still see the visual signs of the destruction, the fire that the invading troops set.
In 1860, this was burnt, yes. So those are sort of scorch marks on the stone. We can see darker marks there.
And also here on that, you can see, do you see the shadow of the fire left on the stone?
When I ended my tour of the old Summer Palace site with Alexandra Harrer, an Austrian who's ended up working at nearby Tsinghua University, she pointed out a final irony. It's the ruins of the Western buildings, that part of the site where Chinese emperors built in a European style, that's become for modern China a symbol of Western barbarity.
What they chose as a modern sign to represent the Yuanmingyuan Park are the ruins of the destroyed Western palaces. You can find that on every entrance ticket, on every publication.
It's an irony though, isn't it? Because people are coming here and becoming very angry about what was done by the British and the French.
Yes.
And here's this bit of architecture that's European in style.
Yes, but unfortunately by doing so, it seems to me that it is too much of an emphasis on the destruction of the palace. And it is a neglection of the beautiful part, the Chinese-style part, that has been here.
Yuanmingyuan perfectly embodied the cultural history of China, concludes the digital reconstruction made by Tsinghua University. But the film ends on a mournful note, recalling a magnificent treasure that once shed the light of perfect brightness on the world. It reminded me of those British observers who, in the very act of destroying this place in 1860, spoke of it as a wonder that would now be lost forever. But its memory constantly resurfaces. The megaphones that follow you around the ruined site amplify official Chinese outrage. Artworks surfacing in Western auction houses stoke the anger. As the story of the old Summer Palace reminds us, embracing China's powerful future also means engaging with its painful past. That BBC documentary was presented and produced by me, Chris Bowlby. The editor was Richard Knight. The readers were Sam Dale, David Acton, and Ian Cunningham.